Anderson heaving one down the sideline, and he's got Cass Allen.
Listening to the Bruin Bible. This is your host, Will Decker, bringing you UCLA football content all throughout the year for LA Football Network.
What is up, Los Angeles? 1090 ESPN Radio. It is Friday. Spring has sprung here officially in Los Angeles. Getting close to spring football for your UCLA Bruins. A welcome sign after the Pac-12 basketball tournament. But man, spring football is here. Deshaun Foster entering his first spring as head coach of UCLA football. I got the madman per usual to my right. Madman, what is going on, bro? We have football right around the corner for UCLA and a spring game on top of that.
No, it's so exciting, Thriller. Obviously, the spring practices here begin in about 12 or 13 days. We're going to have a spring game at the Rose Bowl. 8 days prior to that, we're going to have a Friday night lights practice, which is going to be so epic. Just can't wait. This is just so exciting. A turning of the page of the program. So much infusion. And just a wonderful pro day that we've had 10 days ago. And just so much energy and enthusiasm in the program. So can't wait to be covering it with you.
Yeah. And before we get into our day's topic, did you see Steph Curry come through the Wasserman Center?
Last week. Yes.
You had Djokovic that you missed, but that, you know, broke your
heart. I'm still crying over that. Hashtag too soon. Yeah.
Anybody that knows me, I am the biggest Curry Warriors fan coming from Oakland, California. Remember, bro, I've never been more jealous to not be at the Wasserman Center for that. Chris Paul was there talking to our new quarterbacks coach, you know, Dwight out there. I mean, it was very, very cool, man. So lots of great stuff going on. But the topic we came up for today's episode, we want to break down the guys who are excited for spring ball. Some guys we haven't seen really stand out on the football field. Some guys are going to be stepping into new roles. Some returning players that could make that next step up to all-conference performer and become those UCLA players we really remember at the end of the day. Madman, I thought this was a very fun exercise. What are your thoughts going in to us breaking down the top players from spring?
Oh, it's very exciting, Will, because so much of spring production carries over into the season. If we, you know, circle back the clock about 12 months here, a lot of the guys, Will, that we thought were sort of prized for a breakout, given how they played in spring, it panned out that way. Strengths in terms of units of the team, it played out that way. Weaknesses in terms of units of the team, it sort of played out that way. So many of the habits, the behaviors, the practices matter so much at this particular point in the season, because this is sort of what carries over into the season. So it's almost like watching a baby being born. This is sort of the birth of the 2024 UCLA season in so many ways.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. And, you know, I got some names that I'm very excited to be talking about. As always, I got to give it to my man to the right. Lead us off, man. Who are you most excited about coming into spring football camp for the 2024 season for UCLA?
Yeah, well, you know, I'll do this sort of as a group of five here in no particular order. But one guy I've got my eye on is Rico Flores, the transfer from Notre Dame. And, you know, the kind of the speedster, had 300 yards receiving, 3 touchdowns with Notre Dame last year, and sort of coming in now to sort of complement this wide receiving group. Obviously, you and I joked offline that he's got some very large shoes to fill, Will, in the departure of Kyle Ford. And you and I joked, obviously, Kyle Ford, the guy who I thought was going to play just a hugely significant role on the team last year and had all but 38 yards receiving, it felt like, on 5 catches. I'll always have the 5 for 38, Will, to miss. But I think Rico Flores steps in here with an opportunity to really be that guy that blows the top off the defense to sort of complement the possession type of receiver that is Logan Loya, and then obviously the explosive big body that is J. Michael Sturdivant. So I kind of want to see how Rico Flores integrates into this system and how comfortable Ethan Garbers is with him.
Yeah, I love the Rico Flores comparison. I mean, this guy was highly touted, Notre Dame guy. We're going to have to get this into this later in the episode. Butler Benton, the director of player development, the GM of Notre Dame football, coming to UCLA. So that's going to be very exciting as well. But getting back to Flores, a very talented wide receiver. I see him more as a slot guy as opposed to an outside guy from what I've seen early. but he can make the tough catches and run the right routes where he's going to get a lot of targets when he's on the field. A lot of promise there. You know, his 3 more years of eligibility, to my knowledge, for UCLA with Rico Flores. So just a lot of great things to like, man. So Rico Flores, a very valuable first choice. Here's the guy I got for you, and this is a guy that we saw in spring football last year. Braden Pagan, man. I mean, he was behind a stacked receiving core, you know, of your Fords, your Sturdivants, your Loyas. Very talented. I think Loya's going to have an opportunity to go to the NFL after this. I think Sturdivant's going to be a top 3-round pick in the NFL next year. But with Pagan, he was arguably the second best receiver we saw in spring practice, whether that lined up to on the field playing time. I mean, this guy has 1 catch in 2 seasons at UCLA for 7 yards against Cal last year. But what Pagan brings to the table, big-bodied outside receiver, 6'4", 200 pounds. And, I mean, we routinely saw it. He was making one-handed grabs. He was torching DBs, mossing guys with that size. Such a hard cover out there on the football field. And I'm really excited to see if he can take that next step to ultimately being the guy opposite your Loyas or your Sturdivants in that situation. What do you think about Pagan coming into the spring?
Absolutely, Will. You said it best. Pagan really stood out last year in the spring when it came to torching the defensive backs who ended up having really good seasons. When you think about an Alex Johnson, when you think about a Kamari Ramsey, when you think about some of these guys that were on this roster last year and the type of success that Pagan had, it was really remarkable. He was clearly the number 2 receiver in spring last year after J. Michael Sturdivant. And you talked about it, Will. It was in a variety of ways, whether it was his catch radius and being able to catch some contested back shoulder balls, whether it was sort of going across the middle and being able to catch balls in traffic, whether it was showing some really subtle speed in terms of some move variations and then kind of creating separation down the sideline. And then also his ability to have a knack to be open in the red zone. He did a little bit of everything in the spring. Let's see if it translates now this year on the field. And I think what will help significantly is, if you recall, Will, he had a great chemistry with Ethan Garbers in spring. And so now hopefully with Garbers kind of taking that reign and sort of going through it unanimously, the QB1, unquestionably his team, no one to sort of look behind his shoulder. Hopefully now Pagan and Garbers develop a chemistry that stays consistent throughout the season. And this translates to on the field success.
Yeah, so we got 2 wide receivers off the board with our first 2 picks. Madman, number 3, lead us to where we're going for the spring and who we got our eyes on in these open spring practices, my man.
Yeah, Will, I got my eye on the Georgia Tech transfer, KJ Wallace, in the secondary. And when you talk about what KJ Wallace brings to the table in terms of game experience and pedigree from Georgia Tech, he had some of his best games against some of the top competition in the country. When you talk about the Ole Misses and the Georgias and the likes of, you know, really top flight competition, Clemson, to name a few, really played big in the biggest games. And one of the position groups that really sort of separated last year in spring and stood out was the secondary. And now when you look at kind of the secondary turnover, when you talk about losing Ramsey and Humphreys, Alex Johnson terms out, when you talk about really trying to figure out who that next captain of the secondary is going to be, a void that we haven't yet filled from the days of Blaylock, you know, 2 years ago, can KJ Wallace potentially be that guy on the back end? And I want to see how he matches up with the high level of competition that is in that UCLA wide receiver room, how he competes and where he really fits in terms of zone scheme, cover 2, cover 3, whether he's more bump and run. He did a little bit of everything at Georgia Tech. Can he sort of take that next step and serve in that leadership role in the secondary?
Yeah, I love Wallace. You know, another former Notre Dame and Georgia Tech guy coming here. A lot of experience. He's going to be back there, you know, with some very tested corners. And I think, you know, spoiler alert, I'm going to have another corner in that conversation coming forward. So KJ Wallace, the addition of him coming to this was such a need, especially with Ramsey and Humphreys leaving for USC. So this is a very, very big pickup for UCLA. So I'm excited to see how he progresses with this new defense. You know, Cody Whitfield was the Pac-12 defensive back coach of the year last year. So let's see if he can kind of build on that, bring these new guys in, get them comfortable out there playing, and see how they align in spring ball as they head to a big new conference in the Big Ten. So it's going to be very fun to watch what Wallace does out there. I'm going to go defensive back a little later. The guy that I have, and it's such a need coming into this year because we had such a dominant unit last year. I'm talking about the defensive line. You lose the Murphy twins. You lose Liatu Latu. I mean, those guys don't grow on trees. I've said that many of times. Those guys are all future pros. Latu, if it wasn't for the medicals, would be a surefire top 10 pick in the NFL draft. Murphy's going to be day two, maybe even day three picks. The guy that I got, and I went back and looked at his recruiting profile, Collins Achampi Young is built like nobody I've ever seen. Yes. He's 6'7", 270 pounds, madman. This guy went to Miami, transferred to UCLA, has 4 years of eligibility left. And you look at the offers and the recruiting profile for that size, whether it was your Texas's, your Oregon's, your Michigan's, like the big name brand schools all wanted this guy. And somehow he just winds up at UCLA a year later. Can't teach size is the one thing my grandpa always said as a college basketball scout. You know, size rules all. 6'7", 270, coming with a coach that just put three players in the NFL. I am excited to see that, especially at a position of need where we need somebody to step up on those edge rushing positions. Achampi Young is a guy that I'm going to have my eyes set on, man, because size, speed, flexibility. He used to be a basketball player, so he's super athletic. I like everything I'm hearing about Achampi Young. To be able to see him on the spring practice field is going to be a treat for me just to kind of evaluate him and what he's going to bring to the table. What do you think about Achampi Young?
Oh, I love the Achampi Young comp here, Will. And I'm so happy you brought it up because we were so excited about this get about 60 days ago. And how much has happened in the UCLA offseason since then between Chip and Deshaun and Eric Bieniemy and all of the movement that he kind of became the forgotten guy. And I think that him stepping out on the field with that 6'7" frame that you mentioned and just that sheer raw athleticism, explosiveness to be able to fill those voids, I think it's going to be really exciting to see. And we saw that in spades last year in the spring, Will, when we said, either this front seven is really, really good or this offensive line is really, really bad. But this front seven is sort of living in the backfield right now. And truth be told, both were true. It was sort of an and. So Chiampong has an opportunity to make an immediate impact here, and I think he's going to do that. And as we've talked about, in modern football, modern college football, obviously you need to be able to score the ball in this day and age. But the one advantage you have on the defensive side is your ability to get to the quarterback and strain pressure. And no better than Achiampong. And he's got some big shoes to fill, but he's got the frame to sort of carry that load. What a great pick there, Will. I love it.
Awesome, man. Well, Champ Young, we got four picks total. We're going to try to go 3 for 3 at the very least for this radio segment. If we go a little bit long, guys, make sure to check us out in the Bruin Bible. We have everything, the full episode, all listed out for you guys. Number 3 for Mr. Madman. Who are you going with and why?
Well, this is kind of an interesting one for me. And I think that there's one guy that has the opportunity to really make a huge name for himself this year along the lines of Achampi Young, and that's Olufemi Oladijo and where he's going to be, positioned here. And I'm going to cheat a little bit because I think that Oladijo is going to play a very significant role on this team, but I don't know how much we're going to see that in spring. You know, it was kind of like Latu last year. We knew Latu was great, but the spring practices had a little bit less physicality in terms of what those guys wanted to do. I mean, Latu was just ready to kill people and just hit people and just go nuts on people. And you could tell kind of Chip and Deshaun and everybody else was kind of reining him in a little bit. And I think it's going to be a similar story with Oladijo, but I think he's going to play a significant role. I'm fascinated, Will, to see how John Vance is going to be positioned on this team this year. Yeah. You know, is he going to be kind of this hybrid linebacker safety role? Are you going to put him more in the box? Are you going to have him kind of play more coverage? He's so versatile. And I think last year, so much of his baseball kind of came into impacting some of his spring production. Now he's got another year under his belt of playing both sports. I think there's going to be a different mentality and focus coming into football this year. And I think, again, where he's positioned, how he plays, who he matches up with, and where his utilization is best, he has the ability to sort of change the complexion of a season given his versatility. Really excited to see John Vons this year.
Yeah, John Vons, I think there was a, you know, if we did not get the Wallaces coming through from Georgia Tech, I think there was a real shot he moves to safety. And like, maybe that's a better position for him projecting towards the next level if he wanted to take a shot within the NFL. So John Vaughns is great. Oladeja, though, man, that was a guy that was on my list, and I like everything about him. You know, he came in. It didn't feel like he blew everybody away, but that linebacking room was so loaded last year, whether it was Kane Medrano or Darius Mouassa, who's going to be playing on Sundays. You had a loaded room, and, you know, the first game we saw, Oladeja, 10-tackle game against San Diego State, you're like, man, this guy's going to get 120 tackles this year. Not the case. The most he had since that game was 8. You know, he finished the bowl game in a really nice way, 6 tackles, 3 solo tackles in that game. But the thing that really stood out to me, which makes him a complete freak of nature, this guy had 3 pass deflections at 6'3", 250 pounds. We talked about it last year when he was with DK Metcalf, who came out to the – we didn't know who was who. Like, those guys are just massive human beings, you know. And I just think the size and speed he can have, and if he, you know, improves upon that coverage, this guy can be like a day 2 pick in the NFL, maybe even day 1, because he's one of those guys that if he locks in and has a year he had 2 years ago with Cal – he's going to blow it away at a combine-like environment where the measurables are what you need. And at 6'3", 250, let's say he does run like a low 4.5, he's going to be on the NFL, you know, track record to maybe becoming one of those linebackers like a Fred Warner or one of these guys in the coverage game, Patrick Queen, Roquan Smith, these type of guys. So I'm all about Oladeja. I'm really excited to see what he brings to the table. And that leads me to my next pick, man. You know, this is very obvious, but I think it needs to be said. Like, we have to put him out there. Garbers, with a new offensive coordinator,
you took it away from me.
Finally having the starting job, I think, is massive for him, because you look at all the struggles he's had over the years. It's started at Washington as a 4-star prospect, came down to UCLA, you know, fought for the backup job with Dorian Thompson-Robinson, who came back for an extra year. People forget that. Like, was Dylan Gabriel going to come or not? That doesn't matter. Garbers was still going to try to compete for that starting job. DTR comes back, eliminates him from that starting job. Finally feels like he's got it last year. They get a 5-star true young freshman, Dante Moore, who for a lot of people, you know, wanted him to start. I would say like 90%+ of the fan base wanted this guy to start. And it's one of my big regrets is that I pivoted on this last year, because in spring football, he was the best quarterback at spring football for all those practices we saw. But everyone's like, if you don't get Dante, it was very similar to the Brady Drew Henson thing, if you will, where I'm not comparing these guys projecting wise forward, but Brady was the older statesman. He had the locker room. The players liked him, but they had this new young quarterback. They were scared they would lose him if they didn't play him. And lo and behold, it kind of played out very similar, where the younger quarterbacks were very inconsistent, didn't get the respect of the veterans within the locker room. And then you have a guy come in like a Garbers or Brady who'd been there, who put in the work, and you saw it pay dividends, man. That second half against Boise State, 9 of 12, 156 yards, 2 touchdowns, 3-touchdown performance against USC in the Coliseum. I mean, come on. Those are games that you dream about as a quarterback playing college football and making that work. I just am so excited to see what he's going to bring to the table now that he knows he's the starting job. But there's also the challenge of, hey, I'm learning a new, you know, under a new offensive coordinator. This could be a little different for me. So just a lot of questions with Garbers, but all the best kinds, because we know he's going to be great. What do you think about Garbers there?
No, that was going to be my other one, Will. So I'm so happy that we aligned there as we tend to do. And I couldn't agree with you more, because the dynamic with Garbers last year in spring, it was very interesting. It was very obvious to your point that he had a greater command of the offense. He understood the playbook more, the complexities more. There was more decisiveness with his reads and with his balls than was the case with Dante Moore. Where it became interesting was in off-script type of situations, improvisational situations, Dante significantly beat Ethan Garber. So then it became a question of, well, if Moore just sort of catches up on the learning of the offense, this is going to be hard for Garbers to beat. There was also an interesting dynamic in the quarterback competition. You and I both noticed that. Garbers would tend to be sort of on one part of the sideline. Moore tended to be on another part of the sideline. There was no animosity, but there also wasn't a lot of camaraderie either. And so how that played out in the season, while Garbers looked like he had sort of mastery of the playbook, as we talked about in that opener, he lost confidence very quickly on one bad throw. And that sort of set him into a bit of a tailspin the first half of the year. And then he reclimated that in the second half of the year, particularly with SC and Boise State. So I'm really fascinated to see. He's the unquestioned QB1. He's won this team over in the bowl game. He's won the rivalry game. He's got the victory bell in hand. How does he go about his business, not just learning a new offense, but what is he going to be like from a leadership standpoint? How vocal is he going to be in the huddle? How much is he going to coach up his guys? How much is he going to encourage the defense? How much of an aura and a presence is he going to have as a coach and a leader on the field? And that's what I'm really fascinated to see. I think the throws he's going to be able to make, the reads he's going to be able to learn, but how does he sort of translate into the unquestioned leader of this team? And how do they in turn respond to him? Because in their response to him, he's going to generate a lot of confidence and self-worth there. And that, I think, is going to take him through the season, regardless of whether there's some early bumps in the road, a couple of early interceptions or what have you. I think that fortification and that confidence in spring hopefully will carry through. So I'm excited to see Garbers, not just from a wrinkle standpoint with this Bienemy offense, but him taking that final step as the unquestioned leader of this team, as the unquestioned face of this program, and as an unquestioned coach on the field.
Yeah, and if you're listening to this on LA Football Radio, guys, check out the rest of the episode. We Got You is going to be on the Bruin Bible. Make sure to check it out. But to your point of Garbers, man, the thing that was crazy that played out was when the play broke down, Moore made better plays until it didn't happen in real time. Because how many times right. when it happened and the pocket collapsed and Moore just panicked, where you look at Ethan Garbers, man, this is the Boise State game, 3 carries, 38 yards. Like, he's not a first-read quarterback. We all remember the USC game where he ran for a first down on 13 yards, which really gave them the momentum in that first half to take the lead. So Garbers, you know, for what we saw in spring, it played out completely different because he was just more comfortable with the system. He knew if this doesn't work and that doesn't work, I got to use my legs. Whereas Moore was just trying to play catch up the entire year and it just never worked out.
It also shows, Thriller, that as much as I think spring is a tremendous barometer for certain positions, but it's also not really a correlation to other positions, because the difference between spring and the game was obviously speed of line play, right? When we talked about how much is this offensive line going to hold up in real time, how explosive are sort of pass rushes going to be that they're going to have to deal with, right? The offensive line wasn't really tested very much in real sort of compromising situations in the spring. So it made maybe Garber's strengths feel a little bit deficient, and it made Moore's deficiencies feel like strengths because it wasn't quite that sort of real-time simulation. So that's also going to be, I think, a really interesting piece. Now that there is going to be a spring game, quote unquote, it's not just a spring showcase, it's not just a collection of drills. How does Deshaun Foster design spring practice to lead into a game type of situation? And so are those practices now going to be more reflective of game-like scenarios of you're putting a hat on hat, offensive line with defensive line, so these quarterbacks and these receivers generate the necessary timing and urgency that it's going to be on the field? And I think that's going to be a really fascinating wrinkle to really just even observe Deshaun Foster and how he's going to manage his practices. How vocal is he going to be? What is his coaching style going to be? Is it to pick guys up? Is it going to be to chew guys out? How much is he going to rely on his assistants? What is he going to rely on his assistants for? And where is he really going to emphasize practice being? So I think a guy to watch even more than the players in so many ways is Deshaun, because it's going to be kind of a window into his soul, and it's going to be kind of a window into the soul of the program.
Yeah, man. And just like with Garbers, I'm just happy for him. You know what I mean? He went through a lot to earn that job, and it's going to be fun to watch him. I'm excited to watch the backups play it out, because in a lot of ways, Madman, like, Justin Martin to me felt like the third best quarterback on the roster, yet all the playing time went to Schley when it hit the fan. So does J-Mart step up and be, you know, QB2, kind of what Garbers was, you know, 2 years ago, where he's waiting in the wings, his time's going to be coming, you know, and just things like that. So, like, we have that going on, offensive line development, just a lot of different positions. Do you have any more guys you're excited about? Because I got a couple more and we can keep this thing rolling.
Absolutely, Will. I mean, you know, you mentioned a few. I mean, not in terms of the opening cut, but I think it is going to be really fascinating to see how Justin Martin plays in spring. Because last year, if you recall, Will, so much of our conversation offline was, hey, is Justin Martin going to have to transfer here? Because you know, so much of that was, well, you got Garbers coming in, you got Dante Moore, you're thinking this is now the future of the program for the next 3 years. You've got other recruits coming in. Schley is there, and you know Schley is going to be sort of a rental for 2 years because he's going to law school and doing all of these things. And so look how quickly things change. We're a very talented guy like Justin Martin. We were talking, hey, maybe does he go to Cal? Does he maybe go to Washington State? Does he go, you know, to the Mountain West? Now he has an opportunity to step up here. We saw some of the deficiencies with Schley. Does Schley sort of improve as a pure thrower, or does Martin have the ability to pass him and be QB2 and be one unfortunate Garbers hit away from being the quarterback and playing some really meaningful games in the Big Ten? So I think Martin's development is going to be really fascinating to see how much time he's put in the film room, the weight room, in terms of looking at how he wants to be set up for success. And so for me, Thriller, I think the other guys that I'm kind of looking at a little bit is, where do we see kind of the tight end room? And, you know, is this also the year that, you know, Habermel and Matavau, is there some separation there? You know, over spring last year, it was pretty obvious that Carson Ryan looked like the most talented tight end in the spring last year, if you recall. And he was making some huge plays, and we were expecting some big things, and he delivered. And now, unfortunately, Ryan has transferred to Utah. So what is that battle between Habermel and Matavau going to look like, and is there going to be some separation? You know, 18 months ago, it looked like Habermel was maybe going to be that next tight end. Ryan then came in and wedged in. And then over the course of the season, when Garbers kind of came back into that second wind of his, he really liked Matavau a lot. And then at the very end of the season, Habermel came on in that SC game, you know, got into the end zone. So are we going to see some separation there, or is this going to be more of a tight end battle through and through, and it's going to be a two tight end system? So seeing how those two guys interact and play off of each other, who's going to block more? What type of routes are they going to run? Is it seam routes? Are they going to go across the middle? I think that interplay is going to be fascinating to watch.
Yeah, no, those are two very fascinating observations you made about the tight end room with Matavau and Habermel. Carson Ryan leaving is a big loss. Like, that's a guy that, yeah, you know, the numbers, it was similar to what Kyle Ford did, right? Every time he got targeted, he made a play. So you can't say it wasn't bad. They should have thrown him the ball more with Carson Ryan. You know, I remember the catch he made on fourth down against Utah, ironically Utah, where he transferred to keep the game alive. Like, it was a hell of a play by Carson Ryan. And the other point is Matavau and Habermel. I think they're going to be tight ends by committee coming in on paper, but what if one significantly outplays the other? That's the really fun and exciting part about spring football, especially with a new coaching staff at Old. You got to earn the trust of these new coaches because they don't know who you are. Like, you got to prove to them that you're tight end number one or tight end number two. So that's going to be a fascinating battle to watch play out. I've got a guy for you too, man. Defensively, we have talked about this guy maybe for 3 years. Similar to Loyola, where it's like, this guy's going to break out. Devin Kirkwood, man, I felt like he really, you know, progressed at the end of the season last year. You know, after that Stanford game where he forced a fumble, intercepted Caleb Williams in the USC game, made some plays against Boise State where you're starting to see that potential kind of catch up to where he's at right now in terms of talent level. So I think with Kirkwood, talent has never been an issue. It's always been consistency, snap to snap, how he's reading it. I saw him take a step forward at the end of the season with Cody Whitfield last year, and I'm excited to see what they do with Davies and Kirkwood for my money, which could be a top three, you know, cornerback duo within the Big Ten if everything goes right for them next year. I mean, talk to me about Kirkwood. We talked about him for years, and I think, you know, I'm tripling down. This is my new Kyle Ford, man. This is my guy. Like, I am putting him out there as a guy that I think is going to hit big this year because of how he finished last season and the progressions he made. What do you think about Kirkwood?
Oh, God bless, Will. Absolutely. You know, my five catches for 38 yards is is your interception against Washington 2 years ago. You know, he's teased us ever since then, you know, with that one play. And we've talked about the value of the big corner and being able to kind of grow into his body, grow into a physical corner, but also sort of grow into sort of a mentality of preparation and meticulousness for his craft and really sort of use his hands well, use his hips well, and really sort of generate a lot of production on the field. I completely agree with you. I think different guys mature at different ages. We sometimes forget that we're talking about 18 to 22 year old kids here. And so some kids are ready at 18 to come in, make an impact, be disciplined, and just do the things they need to do to be successful. For others, it's a little bit more of an ebb and flow. I mean, we saw it with Alex Johnson last year, you know, year six in the program, essentially, and then have this incredible renaissance period. So I completely agree with you. How Kirkwood played, particularly against USC with that interception, but also just the rest of the way through, when you talk about him locking up Taj Washington, when you talk about him kind of going shot for shot with Brendan Rice, not backing down, and then you look at how he did in the LA Bowl and the way that defense really locked things up in the second half. Can he take that potion? Can he take those ingredients and translate it over into the season? And I think it's set up very well for him, Will, because the Big Ten has maybe some bigger receivers, some guys that maybe aren't as twitchy as were in the case in kind of the traditional Pac-12. And so I think it can fit into his body type a little bit more, where he can use his strength and his body type to potentially overpower some of these receivers at the line of scrimmage, get the requisite leverage that he needs, and be able to sort of shut these guys down, or be able to get them off script, off timing, off schedule, and really disrupt passing plays. So I totally agree with you. It's all set up for him for a big year. And I think it comes down to an element of personal belief. I think 2 years ago, he made plays here and there, but I don't know if the belief was there that he was ready to be a leader in this secondary and a bona fide starter. And I think the confidence ebbed and flowed. Now, I think he's in a situation where he believes that he belongs, that he's a leader, he's a star, and let's see that translate week over week.
Yeah, and you know, before I toss it back over to you, there's something to be said about guys for UCLA specifically when they have that game against USC. Like Greg Dulcich, his breakout game really was the USC game a couple years ago. And he comes back, he's arguably, he was my opinion, the best tight end in the country when he came back for that year. Even Dorian Thompson-Robinson, there was a confidence. When he started those 8 to 9 games, you know, the next season, he was a legitimate Heisman candidate before it kind of broke off at the end of the year. There's something to be said about balling out against your rival and taking your steps to the next level. And Kirkwood, you know, confidence always looked like an issue for him out there. You know, very talented, but he, you know, make a mistake, and it looked like he got in his head a lot. You know, similar to how I felt with Klay Thompson earlier in his career with the Warriors to kind of pivot to a different sport. But when you have that confidence going, listen, I just picked off the number one pick in the NFL draft, and I was a huge part of the reason why we beat USC, our crosstown rivals, that confidence starts to glow. You know, like once you have that first achievement, you can be a very, very different person in the good way. Like your confidence, you believe in yourself more. So after seeing the track records of what happened to previous UCLA players when they balled out in that USC game, what I saw from Kirkwood end the year, I think we could be in for something nice with Kirkwood. It may have taken a while, but we could be at that destination right here, Madman. Any more players for you off the top of your head before we wrap this up?
No, Will. I mean, I think we've sort of covered it end to end in a really significant way. And I just love the point you made about the power that USC game has on the following season and in many ways on a career. I mean, when you think about even going back pre-Chip or early Chip, I mean, think about what the USC game meant for Joshua Kelly in terms of his signature performance, not just from a UCLA perspective, but the confidence it gave him to be a very credible NFL player for a few years. When you talk about the way Demetric Felton played against USC and competed so hard, even whether it was wins or losses, but put up big numbers, and then what that meant for him in the NFL. You go even further back, look at what it meant for a Jonathan Franklin. Look at what it meant for a Brett Hundley. Look what it meant for a Jordan Payton. Guys that have played USC really well, it's either translated into some significant confidence the following year or the rest of their UCLA career or their ability to be really solid NFL players. I mean, you saw the way Miles Jack played against USC, the way Anthony Barr famously knocked out Matt Barkley. I mean, Anthony Barr ended Matt Barkley's career at USC, and you saw what a season he had. Kendricks, the way he played against SC en route to winning 3 consecutive games from 2012 to 2014. So the power of that SC game means so much to sort of UCLA culture. It also speaks to, you know, the most recent interview that Deshaun Foster had this year, you know, with the LA Times, where he was sitting in his office and right behind him was a Bruin Bear that was sitting on top of a sign, and the sign literally read, kill SC. And so, you know, and this is sort of the highest sign he's got in his office right behind him. So the power of that game and what it means, not just to this program, but to these individual players' confidences is absolutely significant and can't be understated. And I think Kirkwood and the rest could be this next wave. You know, is it Habermel? Is it TJ Harden taking that momentum now to be unquestioned RB1? Of course, Garbers. You know, is there an opportunity now for a litany of these players to say, we did this with our rivals, we run LA, now let's run more than just LA going into 2024?
Yeah, man. Great points. Great time having, you know, talking about what we bring into the table in the spring portion of football. Football's back, baby. 365 days a year. We got you covered here at Los Angeles Football Network for your Bruins. Check us out. Make sure to like us, subscribe on YouTube. We'll be back very soon. We're going to be out there at practices, guys. So come up, say hello, give us your opinions, give us where you guys think we should, you know, pivot to with the podcast. I'm interested to hear what you guys got to say, man. Have a blast. We will be back very soon. Bruin Bible.